Hello, I'm Mubeen Azhar and I'm in Soho in central London. It's the social heart of the city, home to theatreland, trendy bars and clubs where tourists and locals alike come to party. Historically, Soho is also home to London's sex industry. Today, it doesn't fit the grimy notion of a red light district. Sex shops and brothels have given way to identikit coffee shops and chain restaurants. But Soho's gentrification is only a thin veil for London's booming sex industry. If you scratch the surface, there's still plenty of sex on sale here today. I'm on my way to meet a man who's one of the new generation of sex workers, young, male, and gay. He's agreed to meet me after I contacted him through his website, which is how many modern sex workers do business.
Hello.
Hi, I'm here to see Josh Brandon.
Okay, come in.
Thank you. Josh Brandon is one of London's best-known male escorts. His image is more rock star than rent boy. Originally from a small village in Wales, he came to this city 4 years ago with big dreams of fame. Short, slim and crowned with flowing blonde locks, he's what could be described as a twink. That's gay slang for pretty boy. He invited me into his plush Soho apartment. Josh,
hello.
Hi, it's Mubeen. How are you? It's
nice
really nice to meet you. How are you?
Good to see you.
Okay, Josh, thanks so much for taking the time to see me. So what have you been up to?
I just got back from Germany. I was out there for 3 nights.
Okay, and you in Germany for work?
Yes, I was flown out by a client who was not from Germany, but he was in Germany on business.
Is that normal? Do you often get flown out by clients?
Yeah, quite regularly, yeah.
Okay, and very personal question, how much money did you get paid?
It was just under 4,000 for the 3 nights.
So you got £4,000 for 3 nights work to have sex?
Yeah, that's normal when I'm flying away and all that, yeah.
What is the most money you've ever made?
The most money I've made was probably in New York in like a month period of time. And I think I made about £30,000 while I was in New York. And that was a big month.
You made £30,000 in a month?
Yeah, in New York City.
And I mean, you talk about that and you just say, yeah, as if that's not a big deal. But for the majority of people, especially in this economic climate, £30,000 is a year's wages. How can you make that in a month?
Yeah, and I mean, it's not common. I mean, I've made similar amounts. That was the most. And that was because I hadn't been back there for a while. So I had a bunch of clients, like, built up a lot of appointments and they were requesting me to get out there. So when I was out there, I was just non-stop busy for a whole month.
Josh, who are your clients?
Well, it's a very diverse bunch. I don't know if it's the Americans, like USA, or Arabs that are the biggest clientele. It sometimes switches between the two. I would say the youngest client I've got right now regularly is 21, I think. It's about my age, and yeah, all the way up to maybe 80 or so. In age-wise, and income brackets, I've met billionaires, and then I have 9-to-5 workers. When I was out in Germany, actually, the client I met there, he was an arms trader.
He was an arms trader?
Not, like, illegal. I don't mean the, you know, illegal ones. I mean, like, he sold arms to governments and countries.
Okay, and is this a regular client? Is it someone that you've seen before?
That I had seen him before, yeah.
So how do you get people coming back to you? What do you do to draw them in?
Okay, well, first of all, it's figuring out exactly what the client wants and delivering it on an individual basis. Also, I do have my VIP loyalty card.
You actually have a loyalty card?
Yeah.
Well, like Starbucks or
Starbucks? Exactly like Starbucks. You put a stamp on it each time you get a cup of coffee, or in this case, each time you spend 1 hour.
Are you serious? So you literally, you have loyalty cards and you stamp them?
Yeah, but when it reaches 9 stamps, they would have another 3 hour, and that's how it works, and it's very effective.
It does work.
Yeah, it definitely does.
Do you think London is a good place for you to do this?
It's the best place in the world, I think, because you get tourists in the financial service sector, every industry, fashion, everything is right here, so it is a hub for everything, so it is just the best place to be.
Hi, can I get some green tea, please? I'm sitting in a coffee shop just around the corner from Josh's flat on Old Compton Street. That's London's main gay strip. I have to say, I'm just astounded by how much money he's making. His 3-day trip to Germany made him $6,500. Can that really be typical for a gay male escort working in London? I don't know, so to find out, I've picked up a bunch of magazines from one of the gay bars in this area. These mags are handed out across London's gay scene, and they're essentially a kind of what's on guide with club and bar listings. But if you flick to the back pages, you'll see dozens of adverts for male prostitutes, sometimes known as rent boys, although many prefer the more respectable term male escort. Each ad follows the same format, so there's a naked torso, there's some salacious words, and then there's a phone number. It's almost like browsing a restaurant menu with men to suit all tastes. An encounter is only ever a phone call away. I'm going to make some calls and see if I can speak to one of these guys to find out more about what life is really like for men working the gay escort scene in London. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, most of my calls were greeted with suspicion. Some escorts hung up, others asked me why on earth I'd called them for anything other than sex. But eventually, I found another young man willing to speak. I've come to meet Tommy, who's 19 years old, and he's from Brazil. Just like Josh, he lives bang smack in the middle of the city. For any Londoner, this would be considered a prime location. I know that I couldn't afford to live here. I think this is his door.
Tom, how you doing?
Tommy tells me he came to Britain to study English just 3 months ago. His olive skin maintains the sunny glow of Sao Paulo, the city he left behind. With a cheeky smile, he tells me clubbing and parties are the best thing about London. Like many people his age, Tommy was working in a pub to fund his life as a student, but the wages weren't giving him the kind of lifestyle he wanted. He had a Brazilian friend already working as an escort in London. He suggested Tommy give it a try. So that's exactly what he did. He's so popular, our conversation was constantly interrupted by the sound of his phone. It seemed every time I tried to ask a question, a client was trying to get in touch to make a booking.
My phone don't stop ringing.
It's still ringing now. You're getting messages all the time.
Yes. Oh, like that.
Are you making a lot of money, Tommy?
At the moment, yes. Maybe because I'm new in this work, new in London. New guy.
What are your average earnings? How much money do you make?
2,000 per week, maybe. This is simple for me.
Is that average, £2,000 a week?
2,000 a week, yes.
Is that your phone again?
Yes.
Since I've been here, your phone keeps beeping. You keep getting messages from clients. So are you going to be seeing a client today?
Yes, I had.
Oh, you've already had today?
Yes, I had before.
How many clients have you had today?
Two.
You've had two clients before I've even arrived here today. Yeah. So how much money have you made today?
300.
Can I see the money?
Yeah.
Can you count it for me?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 14.
So that's quite a lot of money. It's barely halfway through the day and you've already made that much money.
It's a lot, but the day not finished yet.
Tommy is typical of escorts working in London today. Notably, he's not British. In a city as international as London, it's perhaps not surprising that there are sex workers here from around the world. Someone who's witnessed this influx is Del Campbell from the HIV prevention charity, the Terence Higgins Trust. Del runs an advice service for sex workers.
When we started life as a charity 30 years ago, the far majority were actually UK nationals. And that's changed a lot really over the years. And I would say now probably only about 25% of them are UK nationals. Obviously with the EU, you get lots of people from the EU happily working in the UK. So they probably make up another 25%. And roughly about another 45%, I would say, are migrant workers. And typically a lot of those are coming from Latin America. So sometimes when we do outreach, where we used to find a sort of mix of nationalities. More recently, we've been finding that everyone's from Brazil. But Brasilia has got a reputation for being fairly friendly, quite hardworking. Quite a lot of Brazilian guys identify as straight, and I've got no reason to doubt them. You know, they've got girlfriends, sometimes their girlfriends are sex workers as well. They see it, it's just a job. Close your eyes, think of Brazil.
So why London? Why have they chosen London to come and be their place of work?
Yeah, London's got a reputation. I mean, I was born in London, and we all know London is a bit of an odd place, really, because in some ways it's quite conservative, but also you can be what you like in London. And I think escorting with the general public, British public, is sometimes frowned upon, especially for women. But I think for the men and for the transgender, they find that it's more accepting and there are more opportunities. And also because there's so many people, other people, business people, drifting in and out of London for work, they're the potential clients.
I'm standing in London's Piccadilly Circus. It's a magnet for tourists who come to see the famous statue of Eros, the Greek god of love. It also used to be one of the places male prostitutes would come to sell their services on the streets, often putting themselves at risk of arrest. In England, it's still against the law to buy or sell sexual services in a public place, but it's not against the law if it's a deal done in private between consenting adults. Regardless of the legality and the ease of paying for sex in London, it's still not something that people would shout about. It's just not socially acceptable. For months now, I've been asking Josh to introduce me to one of the men that pay for his services. The vast majority of them refuse to even entertain the idea. But today, I'm on my way to Josh's flat once more to meet one of his most loyal customers. I just hope he actually turns up.
Would you like a drink, pal?
Oh, yes, please.
Glass of wine?
Yes, that'd be great.
At Josh's, I meet Bill, that's not his real name, a distinguished-looking man in his 60s who's known Josh for a couple of years. His smart brogue shoes and tweed suit suggest he has money. I soon learn that he used to be married to a woman. He has adult children too. He's understandably nervous about talking to me, but he agrees to be interviewed. I start by asking him why he feels the need to pay for sex.
You have to remember that people of my age, the whole thing was illegal when we were young.
As in homosexuality?
Yes, the whole thing was illegal.
Was that the case for you then, when you were in your 20s and 30s? Were you not engaging in same-sex relationships or homosexual sex?
No, not at all.
So you got married. Did you know you were gay when you got married?
I think probably bisexual is more the truth of the matter, in a sense. I've had the best of both worlds in changing, if you like, later. That's where someone like Josh has a huge role to play in giving a little bit of happiness.
And when you're making that payment, is it really just about the sexual release? What are you actually paying for?
I think it is at least partly the company. I think that is quite important to a lot of people in my position.
Do you genuinely feel that you're Josh's friend? Do you really believe that? Because your relationship has mostly been based on an exchange of money. That's not the basis of a friendship, is it?
No, I agree. It's a difficult start until he says, no, you can't come and see me, whether it's to chat or for this or that. Then I'll go on thinking that there's still something a bit more than, you know, than purely paying for sex between us.
There is often a perception, though, in society that men that are paying for sex are dirty old men. Do you think it's fair if someone called you a dirty old man?
Yes, quite fair. I'm not bothered about that. What's so amazingly unique about intercourse? Everybody's doing it all round us every day. It's put up on a pedestal in a way that just doesn't make sense in this day and age. I really just don't see that it's such a terrible thing.
But many people would argue that by its nature, the fact that Josh is performing this service for money is exploitative.
No, I don't see it as exploitative. Josh chooses his price. If I don't like or can't afford his price, I don't see him. Exploiting only comes into it if some third party is forcing him to do it.
But aren't you ignoring that Josh in his everyday life, if he wasn't an escort, he probably wouldn't be choosing to spend his time with a man in his 60s, would he?
Absolutely not, no. And that's why I've said it's a very, very difficult job, because it's difficult for him to get any pleasure, if not impossible, out of that. But I just see it as a fair exchange of money for services. It's paying money for their physical expertise.
It was clear to me that Bill gets a lot more than just sex out of his relationship with Josh. He obviously feels an emotional attachment to him, and he's buying more than just sexual gratification. But what's the effect on Josh? Does having such frequent sex with strangers take an emotional toll on him?
I think people make much more of a big deal of it than it is. I mean, for me, I'm pretty light-hearted, I'm easygoing, and I'm very much in the moment kind of person. So once a client's here, I enjoy my time with them and make sure they enjoy. And once they leave, then they've gone. And then I'm in the next moment, which is on my own, sitting on the couch watching TV or or waiting for my next appointment or with friends. And, you know, you live moment by moment.
It's really that easy.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I'd love to give an explanation about how difficult it is, but it's just not. No, I mean, because if I went out that weekend, then, or if I had a boyfriend, I would have had sex, you know, it's the same thing.
Is it really the same thing, though? Because if you have a partner or a boyfriend, that's someone that you know, and, you know, there's some kind of relationship there. But with clients, a lot of the time, I'd imagine that they're strangers. Is it easy to just have sex on demand? Is it easy to have sex for a job?
Yeah, because there's a different level of intimacy. When it's work, and you have sex and you entertain, and it's casual sex, the same way that people have casual sex when they go to clubs, when they go to events, whatever, they pick people up, they have casual sex, and it doesn't mean nothing. There's no bells ringing and fireworks going off. But if you have sex with your partner, then, you know, it's a very different thing, just because there is feeling there. And you have to be able to separate the two, obviously, especially if you're in this business. And that has to come naturally to be able to live in this world and cope.
Do your clients fall in love with you?
It does happen, yeah. And when that happens, I have to say goodbye, because it's no longer a positive experience for them. So I have to say goodbye, even if it costs me a fortune.
Oh, really? So it's not going to be a positive experience for them because they're asking for something that they're not going to get? Is that right?
Yeah, because they're asking for something that is not for sale. You know, that's not a part of what I do. I have my personal life and I have my professional life. And I love being friends with my clients and having friendly relationships. But there's parts of me that they're not going to get access to, you know?
I admit, Josh does seem to be in control. His confidence in compartmentalizing his life seems to work for him. But it's a different story for Tommy, the Brazilian escort who recently came to London. For him, life as a sex worker has been tough from day one.
My first time was so bad, you know, because sometimes it's a good person, sometimes it's a bad person, you know. And for me, in my first time, a bad person.
What happened?
I keep my health, you know. I don't do sex without condom. And some men don't understand this, you know. Some want to sex without condom, and I never do this.
So your first client wanted you to have sex without a condom?
Yes.
So what did you say to him?
Choose another boy that have HIV, because I don't do, sorry.
So did you leave him?
I was so angry about, because I was feeling bad, I was feeling sad, you know.
Do you enjoy your work?
No, I don't enjoy it.
You look upset now, actually. I'm sorry, you look like I've asked a sensitive question.
I can enjoy this work sometimes with beautiful clients, you know, delicious clients, you know, because I can win money and can enjoy the sex, you know. Sometimes it's impossible because the client is very bad and I put outside my house.
You get throw them out.
Get out of my house, take your money and get out. I don't need you. I just need to wait another call.
So, is there anything we can really call normal here? There's Tommy, unhappy with his work, but seemingly addicted to the easy money. Then there's Josh, content to use sex as a commodity like any other. When we've met, Josh has gone out of his way to present a positive picture of his work. I've no reason to doubt his honesty, although it's tough to overcome my own preconceptions about how bad life as a sex worker must be. Speaking to both Josh and Tommy has made me wonder if we humans are really built to have lots of sex on demand, detached from any kind of emotional connection. It's a question I put to Del Campbell from the HIV prevention charity, the Terence Higgins Trust, where he runs an advice service for sex workers.
I think it does actually have a psychological impact on quite a lot of people. In some ways, I think when you're in full-time employment, which involves giving a lot to other people, whether it's a nurse or a sex worker, it probably does have a psychological impact. And the difference they do have, though, sometimes over us, is about the fact that if we just want a rant or we've had a bad day in the office, we can tell our friends and family about it. And for a lot of people involved in escorting, it's harder to do that because of the stigma. If a male escort's had a bad day with his client and wanted to, say, ring his friend about it, possibly the friend might say, well, you brought this upon yourself because of what you're doing.
A lot of the people that I've spoken to have gone out of their way to show me that they're not victims, mm-hmm. and to show me that they've made a career choice, yeah. and they want to convince me that it's a legitimate career choice. Is that really the case for most male sex workers?
I would say it's the case for quite a lot of male sex workers. Obviously, we're a charity, so people who come to us usually need some type of support. In some sense, we do tend to see the ones that are more chaotic, with more issues, including possibly drug issues. But I certainly agree that lots of male escorts are very clued up and organised, and that is one true image of male sex work. But we have to say that we also see the other people. And if I can take an example once where we were giving out condoms, seeing people one by one, and a guy number one said to me that he felt that he loved sex, he loved money, and this was a dream job for him. He was getting loads of sex with clients that he mostly found fairly attractive, and he was getting paid loads of money and using some of that money to go to college part-time. A good life. But then the next guy comes into the room, who's actually from the same part of Latin America, and says that this whole work is destroying his soul, and he kept thinking about what his parents back home would think about if they knew that their son was a sex worker.
I'm Mubin Azar, and you're listening to Boy for Rent on the BBC World Service. Whilst making this documentary, I've come to learn life as an escort is not lucrative and luxurious for everyone. I've heard stories about escorts getting locked in a downward spiral of drugs and unsafe sex. While researching this report, I met one escort in a cafe who begged me for money and said he'd do anything in exchange for £10, that's about $16, to buy the highly addictive drug, crystal meth. So far, people I've met like Josh have been positively evangelical about the rewards a career as an escort can provide. But I want to know, what happens when escorting doesn't have such a happy ending? In part two of this documentary, I'll be investigating the darker side of male prostitution. I'll speak to sex workers who are willing to risk being infected with HIV just to earn a few extra dollars. That's all in part two of Boy for Rent, coming up after the news.
The BBC World Service.
If you're up in the sky...
Welcome to the latest global news. I'm Electra Naismith with a selection of highlights from across BBC World Service news today. Coming up...
Subterranean.
Hello and welcome to Outlook from the BBC World Service. I'm Matthew Bannister. Today, a senior British police officer tells why she became determined to track down...
Or even submerged.
Hello, welcome to Health Check from the BBC. I'm Claudia Hammond. Today, we're devoting the whole programme to the work of...
You can listen to your favourite BBC World Service programmes. Podcasting lets you automatically receive the latest episodes of your chosen programmes as soon as they're available, so you can listen whenever and wherever you want. Go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Coming up in part two of Boy for Rent, we'll find out whether male escort Josh gets a clean bill of health as he takes a HIV test. And I'll be exploring the dark side of male prostitution, meeting a man who for nearly 20 years has been selling sex in order to fund his drug addiction. I'll also be meeting the father of one male prostitute to find out what he thinks of his son's career choice. That's part two of Boy for Rent, coming up after the news.
BBC News with Fiona MacDonald. The International Organisation for Migration is due to start airlifting thousands of foreigners stranded by the crisis in the Central African Republic. The IOM said about 33,000 people from neighbouring countries were living in increasingly desperate conditions. Almost a million people have been displaced by months of fighting between Muslim and Christian militias. Sporadic violence continued overnight in the capital, Bangui. The army in South Sudan is preparing for an offensive to recapture the only major town still held by rebel forces, Bor. Troops have been seen boarding barges heading for the front line. Government forces retook the town of Bentiu on Friday, but the former Vice President, Riek Machar, has insisted he withdrew his forces to avoid civilian deaths. Several people have been injured in the Ukrainian capital Kiev in clashes between the police and protesters. The former Interior Minister, Yuri Lutsenko, was badly wounded. Some reports say he's in intensive care. The violence broke out after a large crowd had gathered to protest against the verdict in a trial against hardline nationalists. The United States Air Force is expanding an investigation into illegal drugs possession by some of its officers. An Air Force spokesman said nine lieutenants and a captain at five bases in the United States and one in Britain were now implicated. In Thailand, seven people have been wounded, at least one seriously, after gunmen opened fire on anti-government protesters in the capital, Bangkok. The opposition wants to block next month's snap election and is calling for Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat and her government to step down. An ancient Tibetan town in the county of Shangri-La in southwest China has been badly damaged by a fire that raged through the night and into the early morning. Duket Tsung, which was founded more than 1,000 years ago, has become a popular tourist destination. BBC News.
Hello, I'm Mubin Azhar and welcome to part two of Boy for Rent here on the BBC World Service. I've been learning about the lives of gay male sex workers living and working in London. It's here in Soho where many of them do business. I'm on my way to meet Josh Brandon, one of the city's best known male escorts.
Floor 4.
I've come to meet Josh at this sexual health clinic, which is open to all members of the public. But being in the middle of Soho, it also runs a special service catering to sex workers making a living here in the centre of the city. Sexual health is something many of the escorts I've spoken to take really seriously, but just because they're using condoms, it doesn't mean they're immune from catching sexually transmitted diseases. So regular checkups are essential. Josh, do you get nervous?
I do get nervous because it's like your health is in someone else's hands for a minute. And then you're going to get told, you know, if you're healthy or not. It does make you nervous. But I have no reason to be nervous, but it's still one of those experiences that, you know, is going to do that.
What kind of stuff do they actually check? What are they looking for?
Hepatitis, syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, HIV, the whole works. And they do a blood test, the rapid HIV test, like a prick to the finger.
So they can tell you instantly whether or not you're HIV positive or negative?
Yeah, for that test, they can say instantly, yeah.
Is that something that worries you?
It's definitely a threat, yeah. And that's why you have to always use protection. You know, HIV is like, some people think it's a manageable thing and you take a few pills and then you're fine. But I have friends who have HIV and, it's, you know, it's not a nice thing for them, even on a social level, the stereotype and all that kind of stuff that goes with it. So that's the thing that I think a lot of escorts don't take into account.
Finally, the time comes for Josh to have his test done.
There's just a little proof.
Yeah.
Well done.
Josh, you look like you're going to cry. Did that hurt?
No, it didn't hurt much. But...
And whilst we wait for Josh's results to come through, I speak to Michael, a nurse at the clinic. He tells me that he's definitely seen a rise in the number of escorts working in London. But surprisingly, the majority, it seems, are keeping safe.
We see a whole range of people who are in the sex industry. So we see heterosexual adult porn stars, gay porn stars, male escorts, female escorts. And I haven't seen an increase in HIV with male sex workers. In the general clinic, there's a huge increase in HIV.
So amongst men who are having sex with men who are not sex workers, yeah, there's a massive leap.
Yeah.
And amongst sex workers, there isn't. I myself find that really surprising.
I think it comes down to awareness. They're using condoms a lot more. But I guess some of the sex workers, it's the job. and they want to keep the clients, then it's about not spreading infections or giving infections.
After a few minutes, it's time for Josh to learn the result of his HIV test.
But that test is negative, so there's no HIV detected. Okay. All right.
Josh, you look really relieved.
I am.
But were you pretty confident?
Yeah, I was expecting negative, but it's always relieving to actually hear it, isn't it?
Do you think with your job there is a pressure to sometimes have unsafe sex? Is that something that your clients have ever asked you to do?
I think when I first started out, then, you know, I was younger, and yeah, I think I did get asked a few times, but something I've never done. There's definitely a lot of guys that do bareback sex.
Barebacking is slang for sex without a condom, something which presents huge risks to the people who do it, as they could contract life-changing sexually transmitted diseases. Both Josh and Brazilian escort Tommy have been asked to have unprotected sex by their clients. They both had the sense to say no, but how many escorts are willing to take that risk just to make some quick cash? I'm online now and I'm going to do a search for escorts working in London. And straight away, you can see there's a whole bunch of websites that advertise escort services. I'm really curious about how many of these escorts will have sex without a condom. So I'm going to put in some calls and find out what they're offering. Hello, are you working today?
Yes, I am, yeah.
Would you be prepared to have sex without a condom?
No, not at all. I do only safe sex.
Do you do sex without a condom?
No way. Thank you.
You just don't do it?
No, I don't.
Can I just ask, do you do bareback sex?
No.
And not even if I pay extra?
Even if you pay £1 million, no.
I don't think he was too happy. He hung up on me because I asked him if he has sex without condoms. Do you do bareback sex?
Yeah, that's on the menu if you want.
That is something that you do?
Yep.
Would you be willing to have sex without a condom?
That's like a big risk for me because I'm negative.
Yeah?
Yeah, it would be like a different price.
Okay, how much would it cost?
It would be like 50 quid more.
50 quid more. Are you worried at all about getting HIV?
Believe it or not, I am.
Would you be prepared to have sex without a condom?
No, one, I love my life, and two, I don't want to get HIV. And I'm an intelligent person, so I choose not to make that decision.
Not even if I would pay extra?
No money's worth putting a price on my life.
Do a lot of guys that call you up, do a lot of them ask for bareback sex?
It's a lot, yeah. Loads of people just want to do it.
So I called 50 escorts in total and 12 of them said yes to sex without a condom. The rest said no, and many were actually offended that I'd asked. A couple of them started lecturing me on safe sex practices. So if you want to look at that positively, then a significant majority of the escorts I called said they would not have unprotected sex. This is just a small sample, but it did reveal why some sex workers are willing to take risks with their health. Quite a few just saw unprotected sex as a way to make a bit of extra money. So some asked for just $50 extra. One of the guys asked for $200 in addition to his regular fee. I do find it really difficult to understand, though, why someone would think the cash is worth it.
Mesdames, messieurs, bienvenue à bord de cette Eurostar à destination de Paris.
To find out more about why an escort might be willing to take risks like this, I took the train from London to Paris to meet a French guy called Nico. He spent many years working as an escort in Paris and London, and he commutes between the two cities every month to meet clients who pay him for sex. From the phone conversations we had before my trip, I knew Nico's experience as a sex worker was a long way from the high-paid success of other escorts I'd met, like Josh.
Can I get you a drink, tea or coffee or something?
At my hotel room, we finally meet in person. Now 40 years old, Nico is tall and slim. His hair is turning grey, and he's clearly nervous. He's adamant, though, that he wants to tell his story. Tell me a little bit about where you grew up. Did you grow up in Paris?
No, I come from Normandy. Normandy, 1 hour by car from Paris, in a small village. And I left home. I was a teenager. I was 16 years old. I went to Paris to start learning to become hairdresser.
But Nico's dream was short-lived. As a boy, he suffered from a condition called hyperhidrosis. This means his hands were always dripping with sweat. At school, he could barely hold a pen or write in a book without the pages getting soaked through, and so he dropped out. After moving to Paris to train as a hairstylist, his problem followed him, and he found he couldn't hold the scissors to cut hair properly, and so he was forced to quit. Alone in Paris and without a job, Nico was desperate for money.
After giving up the hairdressing, I start to prostitute myself, and it was a Gare du Nord.
Okay, yeah, but it was just station. In the train station that's
at
down the road?
The train station, yes, down the road, yes, inside the station.
So how old were you?
I was 16 and a half.
So at 16 you were standing at the train station?
Just to survive, and I didn't like doing sex with them, but...
Were you scared?
I was scared, but for me it was... an easy way to make money. At the same time, perhaps I was looking for a bit of comfort.
But Nico found no comfort in being paid for sex, and emotionally he found it hard to handle. He soon found a way to help him cope. He turned to drugs.
To deal with the fact I think I was hating myself, and I was taking drugs because I didn't like myself at all, and it was just to forget.
Why can't you stop selling sex?
Because I'm still on drug addiction. Because I need money for my drug addiction.
So now you're escorting explicitly because you need to feed your addiction. Would you say that's the only reason?
Yes, yes. All of my life I was spending my money with drug dealers. And in the past, yes, I was using amphetamine. When I was a teenager, because it was easy to get. And I used to do clubbing every night as well, taking ecstasy at night, a lot of cocaine as well, anything stimulant.
What substances are you still using?
Now I'm just smoking crack.
Nico has tried to quit taking drugs. It's why he moved from Paris to London in hope that he could make a fresh start. But he couldn't escape the addiction which has gripped him since he was a teenager. And in London, his desperation to earn money to get high meant he was willing to have sex with anyone, whatever the risk.
Most of my clients were HIV positive, you know, but I've always done my best for not taking any risks. But I have to say, I used to do barebacking sex with clients.
So you would actually have sex with clients without a condom?
Yes, because I was too much desperate and I needed money.
Were you desperate because you needed the money for drugs?
I needed money for drugs, but as well to pay, because in London for 3 years I have to pay rent as well, I have to pay bills. I have to pay, you know, to live as well. London is expensive.
Do you know your HIV status?
Yes, I'm HIV negative.
Some people would say that you've been very lucky if you've had unsafe sex with clients and you're still HIV negative. Do you feel lucky?
I'm still alive and in a good health condition, thankfully.
Tell me if I'm wrong here, but you seem to be saying that you are selling sex because you need the money to fund your drug habit, but you're taking drugs to escape the fact that you're selling sex. So are you trapped?
Yes, I feel like I'm in a trap now. I'm 40 years old. I tried to change the life, to do something else, because it's time for me. But I'm still on drug addiction, yes, and for me it's difficult to stop.
Whether Nico will ever regain control of his life, I just don't know. But sadly, his story is not unique. The cycle of selling sex to feed a drug addiction is common across the world. Nico's now 40 years old, and in a world where youth and sex appeal are the assets needed for success, his opportunities will undoubtedly become increasingly limited. But that goes for all escorts. How long can they keep selling sex? Take Josh Brandon. Playing the young pretty boy is how he makes his money. He says he's still only 21. I'm not entirely sure if I believe him, and he certainly can't stay 21 forever. I asked him what he thinks the future holds, and whether he ever thought he'd be doing this job in the first place. Josh, was this always your intention when you came from Wales and moved to London? Was this part of your plan? Did you want to be an escort?
I wanted to be a model, but I did always know that that was something I could do as well if I needed to. As time went on and I started getting more and more known, I thought, okay, well, I can do this.
So at 21, you're doing this now and you seem like you're enjoying it and you say you're enjoying it. Do you ever worry about life later?
I know I have to prepare myself for when I can't do this anymore, because the young look is definitely my niche and I can evolve, make changes to my look. I can do that. But I need to prepare myself. Like, I have products that I'm trying to bring to market. So I'm looking at my book coming out. I have websites and I've got the trademark for Coverboy, the word Coverboy. I own that in Europe. So Coverboy condoms. I want to do Coverboy underwear. I'm looking at factories in China right now. I'm putting all that work in, and I have been for a few years.
It's interesting because you sound very much like a businessman. Yeah. So is that how you see yourself?
Definitely. I'm a business person first. I'm an entrepreneur who happens to use sex as the product, as the service. And that's what I do.
Everything's straight down the camera, but like what you're doing now is all good.
Whilst Josh's entrepreneurial adventures are still at an early stage, other escorts with similar ambition are already seeing their ideas come to life. In a large and very expensive London apartment, a photo shoot is taking place for the launch of a new smartphone app.
Big smile, yeah. That's great.
The brains behind the idea is Mark, a 40-year-old Australian escort. It's his experience as a sex worker, which he's now applying to his high-tech business venture, which he's called Hook App. Hook App. Hook up. Get it?
Hook App is an application that shows you how far you are from another person. And so, I mean, if you wanted to look for an escort nearby, it would show you the distance that you are from various escorts. And also, the application has very powerful filtering techniques. And then you could find the closest blonde person to you, for example.
How much money has gone into this?
I raised £100,000 for Hook App. That's the whole budget. That includes the development of the software. But I mean, it took a long time. It took 3 years from the beginning of the idea to actually when I got funding.
Are you seeing this as a way out of escorting? If this works, will it be your kind of retirement plan, really? And will it mean that you stop being an escort?
Yes, it will. I always knew that I would have to move on at some point. I mean, I always knew that I would be able to do something. I didn't know quite what, but that's where I've been entrepreneurial since I finished university. And I've just, you know, dabbled in different ideas, and I believe I've got the concept this time.
And yet you've chosen to stay within the same sector in a different role, really, because you're still bringing together escorts and their clients.
Well, I think smart people sort of evolve. So there's so much experience that I have with the industry that it just would have been silly, really, to have just completely left it behind. And I'm very good not only at being an escort, I'm highly technical, I'm very well organized. So I wanted to pull all my strengths and bring them all into one business that could work together.
Do you have any issues with the morality of this? It's one thing working in an industry and making the decision for yourself to be an escort. It's another thing making that industry more and more accessible.
I think it could make it easier for somebody to perhaps decide that they needed to make a little bit of money, and for like reasons like what I did to put myself through university, for example. But prostitution and escorting has been around forever, and it always will be. We're just going to do it in a more up-to-date technological way. And I'm also building safe systems into the application that are actually going to look after escorts. Like, there's a warning about bad clients, and there's also health check messages that would ultimately be a better tool for the industry.
So is this the beginning of a new, respectable and responsible era of prostitution? Whilst escorts like Mark and Josh are happy with their career choice, even proud of what they've achieved through selling sex, I've wondered just how open they really are about their lifestyle. Take Josh. He came to London to be a model, but now he makes lots of money selling sex. How does he explain his success to his family? Do his parents really have a clue about what he does? Hey, good morning. How are you?
Morning. You okay?
I'm all right, thank you. I'm just on Old Compton Street. I'm in my car.
Okay. Can you give me like 10 minutes for the men?
Okay. Cool. See you in a second. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
It's a cold, wet Saturday morning, and I'm waiting in my car outside Josh's flat. We've got a long drive ahead of us today because we're heading west, 200 miles outside of London to the Welsh Valleys. Wales is a country where men are supposed to be like traditional men, and they like things like rugby. They really like their beer. And it's also where Josh grew up. And the reason we're going back is because Josh is going to introduce me to his family. Good morning.
Morning.
Are you all right?
Yeah, I hate mornings.
I have to say, I did not think this would ever happen. I assume Josh's work was something he kept secret from his family, but he says they know everything.
Hello,
Josh. Hello.
Hello. How are you doing? It's really nice to meet you. Thank you. The first stop on our trip is to see his dad.
It's a nice house.
Yes.
It's immediately obvious to me that Josh has a good relationship with his father. And after the exchange of a few gifts and a nice home-cooked meal, we sit down to have a chat. And I start by asking what Josh was like as a boy.
He was very outspoken. There was nothing shy about him. He wasn't a troublemaker or anything.
Was he academic when he was younger? How did he get on at school?
No, didn't get on at school at all. He always used to mitch. It's when he just don't turn up for school, he'd disappear somewhere. So he left school when he was 14 because basically the headmaster didn't want him there. He didn't want to be there.
So did he actually get expelled?
Yeah, yeah.
When Josh was a boy, what did you expect that he'd be when he grew up?
I didn't really know. I knew he wouldn't be into manual working. He wasn't that type of person. To be honest, I just didn't have a clue what he'd go into. I don't think he knew himself.
Can you tell me the first time you knew Josh was escorting? How did you find out?
Well, basically, he just told me what sort of work he was doing. You know, doing a bit of modelling work and escorting work. It was money to survive, and that's what it takes to go by. That's what you do, isn't it? I'd imagine there's loads and loads of people out there doing it. And money-wise, there's good money in it. So, yeah, it is a career for a lot of people.
As his father, are you proud of him?
Yes, I'm proud of him for what he's done. Maybe not what exactly what he's doing, but I'm proud about what he's done. Because he's done well for himself. Years ago, if you'd done something like that, then I suppose maybe your parents wouldn't even talk to you. But at the end of the day, it's what he wants to do. And if I go funny about it, then I end up losing a son or we don't get on. And we've got a good relationship, so I just go with what he does and that's it.
That's Josh's dad. But what reaction did his big brother have when he found out about his escorting?
I think I laughed. It's the same as when he first told me he was gay. I think I was the last person he approached to say he was gay.
Yeah, I think so.
Again, I think he probably expects like a much worse reaction from me than he generally gets, I think. So I went angry. I was worried for him, of course. But it's what he chose he wanted to do, and that's what he's doing. And he's doing it quite well, apparently, so it's fine.
And yet there are people who would say that's irresponsible and that you should have tried to talk him out of this.
I'd agree with them. They are absolutely right. We could have done a lot more. But Josh makes his own mind up at the end of the day, and regardless of what we say, he's going to do what he wants to do.
I could be doing a million things if I wanted to, and I am doing a lot of other things as well, but this is what I choose to do as the main profession. And it's a choice. It is an absolute choice.
Do you think there's been a shift in the acceptability of escorting and sex work?
Yeah, things have changed, definitely. I mean, the youth of today anyway is a lot more accepting of like most things, I think. Sex is just sex, you know? And Josh offers a service to some people who can't get any of that, you know? So I think in some ways, you could look at it, he's actually doing a good thing.
Do you think it can now be seen as a career like any other?
Like, if I could have as much sex as him, I would. I'll get paid for it. So, you know, yeah. No, I don't think it would be seen as a career really. Not yet, I don't think we're there. With my own children now, I mean, suppose if I was to look in that sort of vein, there'd be no way at all that I would allow it or see, you know, any sort of side of it being good.
Really nice to meet you.
It's only a short visit, and it's soon time to make the drive back to London.
Safe journey back now.
Yeah, we'll drive carefully.
But I have to say, it blows my mind how accepting Josh's family have been. If the stigma of sex work is beginning to fade with them, could that also be the case in wider society? Del Campbell from the Terence Higgins Trust says everyone has a role to play if sex work is ever to become more widely accepted.
As a society, I think that we should perhaps question our own attitude towards sex work. We need to all have a think about it. I mean, there's a very grey line between who's selling sex and exchanging sex and who's not anyway in society. And many, many people, men and women, actually are in relationships where there is a sort of, you know, deal. And if it's an arrangement that's not doing else any harm and both parties are happy, then that's fine. So maybe I think that sex workers need to feel more integrated in society, but likewise they also need to be more responsible. And sometimes when we get guys and girls come in sort of saying, oh, I made £1,000 in the last month, well, yeah, we made £1,000, pay your taxes, because I didn't make £1,000 at the weekend. So if you did, you can pay some of that back to the Inland Revenue, who will gladly take it under the guise of a complimentary therapist. So I think sex workers need to be more responsible perhaps, but also for them to do that, they need to be a society where they can be more honest about what they're doing.
It's certainly true that in some societies, sex is less taboo than it's ever been. But will prostitution ever be accepted as a respectable way to earn a living? The internet has completely changed the way in which male escorts are able to work. It's enabled them to reach out to a wide client base, independently and on their own terms. Like any other online entrepreneur, Josh and those like him are able to cut out the middleman. When it comes to prostitution, this means the patronage of pimps and organised crime has been significantly reduced. There are, of course, still victims in this industry, but from spending time with escorts like Josh, it's clear to me that there are also those who are in control, calling the shots and working for themselves. For Josh, it's a choice. It's a choice that he's proud of. Perhaps this unashamed stance is symbolic of an ongoing shift in the way society views sex workers.
My age, I've never met anyone, really, who has a negative opinion of it. But I think a lot of it's the way you do things. Like, if you conduct yourself in a business-like way and you're professional and people don't really expect that that is what you do, which most people never expect that is what I do if they don't happen to know me and I meet them and I say that. But so then they respect it more.
I'm sure there's lots of people who would think morally it's not a great thing to do. What do you think about that?
Well, I think everyone has different morals for a start, and what's one person's morals and not somebody else's, and I grew up in a different generation perhaps. Nothing I do is morally wrong, otherwise I wouldn't do it. And I think it is definitely a generational thing, and it's gonna become more and more open as time goes on.